This is the May 13th, 2025 hearings of the Clark County Board of Equalization. We have 30 minutes scheduled for this property. The hearing before us involves petition number 302 for property ID 104605002. The property is owned by Covington Townhome Properties, LLC. Board members present by video conference are Terry Hagberg, Joel Klein, and Chairman Daniel Weaver. We have Susan Peterson and Andy Hawks here for the assessor's office. And we do have Greg LeBlanc here for the appellant. If you could all three please raise your right hands now to be sworn in.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you give in this hearing will be the truth under penalty for perjury?
I do.
Thank you. Just to let you know, we're independent from the assessor's office. We're here to hear testimony and make a decision on the value of your client property as of January 1st, 2024. Keep in mind, the assessor has the presumption of correctness. You have to overcome that to prevail. Within 30 days after this hearing, you'll get a written response from this board as to the outcome. You have 30 days from that point to appeal to the state. The assessor has that same 30 days to appeal if he doesn't like our decision. So unless you have questions on procedure, I'm going to turn it over to you, Mr. LeBlanc, to further explain your appeal.
Okay, just as a housekeeping matter, we have Joel Thompson, who is a new hire. He's just going to be listening in. He's not going to be providing any testimony, but just wanted to let you know.
Observe. Okay. What's his name?
Joel
Thompson.
Joel Thompson.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So I assume you have our evidence packet, which looks to be about 87 pages long. This is the Covington Townhomes, Northeast 73rd Circle in Vancouver. It's 29 townhomes consisting of 13 duplex and one triplex townhome building. These are two-story townhomes with each measuring three bedroom, two and a half bath. They range in size between 1,314 square feet up to 2,048 square foot unit. And as I indicated, their average unit size is about 1,505 square feet. The townhomes contain a single car garage. Finishes are basic per the 2007 construction era. Include kitchen appliances, laminate countertops. All the townhomes have washer dryers. As of the January 1st, 2024 valuation date, the townhomes were 100% leased. Look on page two, you can see a picture of where the townhomes are located, just north of Orchards, east of 205. Then we have an aerial photograph of the townhomes, showing how they're laid out along the street, just kind of ending in a little cul-de-sac. And pages four, contain a picture of the exterior of the townhomes. We obviously have a difference of opinion as to how we approach the valuation. The assessor prepared a kind of a fee simple value for these homes that would be sold as single townhomes. To single buyers. These particular townhomes have always been leased and rented. So if they were sold off, there would certainly be some carrying costs or there would be a bulk sale discount. So if, if we have units that have been rented for the past 15 years, there's going to be some additional costs to make them ready. There would also be holding costs to sell off. The holding costs would include paying escrow and closing costs, sale commissions, real estate taxes, insurance, and utilities. You would also have lost rent as well. For this, there's also other issues going on with the larger market as well. So we've analyzed these as they have been rented since they've been built. So that is a for rent scenario in which we've placed most value on the income analysis. In looking at the income analysis, there are some issues in the market that are creating a bit of a headwinds, and namely, those are the increase in interest rates. If we look on page 6, you can see the increase in interest rates. The chart on figure A1 shows the dramatic increase from January of 22 to January of 24. You can see that that 10-year treasury rate has gone from 1.75% up to over 4%. And the prime rate has gone from 3.25% up to over 8.5%. The same is true for the 30-year mortgage rate. You can see that that 30-year mortgage rate has jumped substantially from below 4% to now 6%, between 6% and 8%. So it's gone up rather dramatically. With respect to multifamily market conditions, it's on page 8 of our evidence. You can see that the vacancy rate in Vancouver for multifamily is at 8% in 2023 and 7.9% in 2024. And the market rent was actually had negative rent growth in 2023, and it picked up slightly but still only 2% in 2024. So really, we've got flattening rents, increasing interest rates, and this is kind of borne out in the market activity. If you look on page 9 of our evidence, you can see that we had a bunch of market activity in late 2020 through mid 2022. That's the bars on the bar chart there. And then you can see that the values per unit, the blue line is the average value per unit in Vancouver. And you can see that that is peaking in, looks like Q2 of 2022, and it's declining all the way through Q1 of 2024. Our valuation date. So it looks like as of Q2 of 2022, the value for per unit in Vancouver peaked at about $280,000 per unit. And by Q1 of 2024, it declined down to $234,000 per unit. Really quite a significant decline there on a per unit basis, and really it's about a 15% decline from Q2 of 2022 down to Q1 of 2024. If you look on page 10, we have a chart of capitalization rates. This is from CoStar, and it shows that you can see that starting the cap rates bottomed out in Q1 of 2022 when interest rates were extremely low. Once they started to increase, the cap rates started to increase. By our valuation date, those interest rates are per CoStar are above 5.4% and higher there. Also, we've included a cap rate survey from CBRE first half 2024, and that's local to the Portland market. That's attached as Exhibit 3, but that indicates cap rates for Portland suburban range between 5.75 to 6.5. So we've concluded at a 5.5 cap rate. So that's at the low end of the market data range. If we get to look at page 11, that's our income approach. And you can see that we've projected the rents at market. Our projected market rent of 1963 is higher than their actual and asking rent. We've also included expense reimbursements. We've included vacancy at only 5%, even though the market indicates it's higher. We've not included real estate taxes in our operating expenses since we're loading the cap rate. Based on a projected NOI of $540,000 before taxes, we've used a 5.5 base cap rate, plus we're adding 0.95% for the tax load. So we have a loaded cap rate of 6.45%. That indicates a value of $8,374,000 or about $289,000 per unit. If you look on page 12, you can see our actuals, and you can see that this shows the NOI before taxes, and you can see that we've projected that $540,000, which is higher than any NOI before taxes that they've achieved in the preceding 5 years. We've supported our cap rate with some comparable sales as well. Before I touch on those, is there any questions with respect to the income approach?
I have a couple. Do they have common utilities, or are they all separately metered?
I think they have, it looks like, you know, the utilities are running $575 per unit. My guess is that this is mostly water, sewer, I'm not sure about natural gas on this.
So you're saying they are or are not separately metered?
It's tough for me to say. I don't know, I do say that we're getting expense reimbursements of $500. So it doesn't look like they are. If we're getting expense reimbursements of $500 and their utilities are running $575.
And is there a clubhouse or anything, any other amenities involved?
There's no clubhouse.
All right, go ahead with the.
Okay, so we've got some comparable sales, and we provided 5 sales. So the sales range between $335,000 and $387,000 per unit, and averaged $361,000 per unit before adjustment. However, one thing to point is that these are all basically new sales of townhomes, new townhomes built within the last few years, where our 2007 construction. So after adjustments, they range between $262,000 and $328,000 and average $293,000 per unit. The sales are shown, the map is shown on page 14. You can show where, you can see where they are relative to the subject. As you can see, they're all in Vancouver. And if we look on page 15, we have the sales, and you can see that these are townhomes. They range in size between 10 units and up to a high of 49 units. Again, the subject's 29 units. Also, they're new. The oldest are sales 4 and 5, which were built in 2020, and sale 1 was built in 23, sale 2 built in 2022, as well as sale 3. So we have some significant adjustments for, so we've adjusted these for market conditions. The sales have, you know, occurred between late 21 and March of 24. So obviously sales 4 and 5 have received some significant adjustments since they were during superior market conditions when sales per unit were high, interest rates were low, cap rates were low. And if we look, we've also adjusted these for location, physical, age, unit features and amenities, and average unit size. So after the adjustments, we get an average sale price or value of $294,000 per unit. But again, we're placing primary weight on the income approach. Just in conclusion, there's a lot of different factors. We have dramatically increasing mortgage rates above 8% for fee simple purchases. Those mortgage rates are expected to remain high. We also have deteriorating conditions for multifamily with negative rent growth or flattening rent growth and increasing vacancy rates. We have increased capitalization rates and we've seen multifamily values decrease between mid-2022 and the valuation date. On balance, we feel that the income approach is the relevant approach since these are 29 units. They've always been rented since they've been built in 2007. We have an accurate picture of historical expenses and typical investor would not ignore the historical income and expense of a professionally managed property. We've also supported our value with 5 sales of other townhome communities in Clark County. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions or step aside for the assessor's presentation.
I don't have a question, Dan, just for your information, if you look on page 75 of the document that we have, in the assessor's appeal response, it says each unit has individual utility meters.
On where?
It's page 75 of the document that we have.
Okay.
It's the last page of the assessor's appeal response.
All right. Let's hear from the assessor's office.
Okay, that's me, Andy Hawks. Thanks, Mr. LeBlanc and Mr. Thompson, the observer, for your presentation. I will have some overlap, of course, since we're talking about the same property, but I'll try to keep it succinct. Covington Townhomes is a 29-lot platted subdivision of attached zero-lot line homes in Northeast Vancouver. As mentioned by a board member recently, the units are individually metered for at least electricity. I'm not certain about the other utilities. Construction quality is fair with basic finishes, which is common in the property class and certainly of the era of construction. The unit mix is primarily made up of 22 units that are 1,511 square feet. And there are 9 other floor plans ranging from 1,314 square feet to 2,048 square feet. Covington Townhomes is a typical townhome community that happens to be owned and operated by an investor as a income asset. It's fundamentally different than the types of multifamily properties that it might be compared to for an income approach in a variety of ways. Number one, all the lots are individually platted and can be reallocated to different property identification numbers in part or in whole at no cost or significant delay to the property owner should they decide to sell a part or all of their portfolio. That's not typically the case with an apartment complex. Most units are duplex style units, only one of them being of a triplex. So each unit enjoys only one shared wall. So each side has opportunity to have windows on the side and things like that, a more homey feel. Apartments are typically most commonly built in larger blocks for economies of scale and profitability. Then finally, all units in Covington Townhomes have enclosed garages, driveways, and individual yards that are enjoyed by the tenants. Apartments tend to have large open parking lots. They may be covered or not covered. No driveways, and yards are very uncommon. They may have common areas such as a clubhouse or a playground, but Covington Townhomes doesn't share that attribute with the multifamily segment. The county's primary argument does hinge on Washington Administrative Code 457-07-030, which I will read briefly into record. Unless specifically provided otherwise by statute, all property shall be valued on the basis of its highest and best use for assessment purposes. Highest and best use is the most profitable, likely use to which a property can be put. It is the use which will yield the highest return on the owner's investment. Any reasonable use to which the property may be put may be taken into consideration, and if it is peculiarly adapted to some particular use, that fact may be taken into consideration. Uses that are within the realm of possibility but not reasonably probable of occurrence shall not be considered in valuing property as its highest and best use. So the county's argument is effectively, and that we will show by the sales comparison approach, the highest and best use of this property or these properties, all 29 of them, individual properties, is that they are valued as single family residences that are attached, which results in the highest value and therefore the highest profitable and productive use to the owner. The county has supplied 3 separate grids to cover the discrepancies or differences in square footage from the smallest unit to the largest. As stated previously, the bulk of the units are 1,511 square feet. So of the 3 grids, they would the primary document of interest would be the middle one. But just by way of summary, grid number 1 covers the 1,314 square foot unit, The range of value is from $345,000 to $378,000, and that supports the $310,960 assessed value of that unit. The second grid, which encompasses the predominance of the units, has a range of sales from $350,000 to $405,000, which supports the range of values of these units from $309,737 to $320,765. And then finally, the large unit, the range of sales is between $388,800 to $410,000, and that supports the value of that unit of $359,434. Something I think worth noting here is that all of these sales are not only are they proximate to the subject properties in Northeast Vancouver, but they also occurred within the assessment year. So they were subject to the market conditions at that time, whether that be for financing or other options or commissions. So the county stance is that the costs of sale and the factors affecting the market at that time are implicit in the value indicators provided by the sales on the comp grids. We did not perform an income valuation method on this property. It's not a commercial multifamily complex. The petitioner's comparables bear this out. Comps 2 through 5 show typical features of apartment or multifamily properties and transactions. They have large open parking lots. They may have clubhouses. They don't have yards. Most of them don't have garages. And they are bought by institutional investors or individual investors, typically through instruments like 1031 exchanges and things like that. They're just not as prevalent in the single family home market. I think at this time, I'm able to take questions about what I said, but by way of restatement, we believe that the subject properties are fundamentally different from large multifamily complexes for the reasons mentioned, and that we're required by Washington Administrative Code to value the property by its highest and best use, in this case, individual single family attached units on their own land. Thank you.
Andy, do you have any indication as to how many, if any, of these sales were purchased by investors?
You know, I don't. Good question. The predominance of these multifamily, or rather these townhome units, are purchased by individual owners. I would think that these are the same. If it's substantial, I'd be happy to look it up. I would assume that most or all of them are individual owners.
Okay.
Or perhaps purchased as a one-off rental by a individual investor who probably is driven equally by home prices as they are the income.
Would you mind if I chimed in on that?
Of course, Susan.
Great. I agree with Andy's statement. They were all transferred to private parties, not to any LLCs or business names. So it looks like they were purchased for individual occupation as a home. We don't know for sure if they're going to rent that out. Of course, you can buy any property and choose to rent it out. But they're all very close in. They're close to Vancouver Mall. They're the closest comparables that we could locate. Others in Northeast Vancouver might be a little further south, up at 164th, et cetera. So these are all within a very short driving distance. As you probably all know, there are lots of sort of zero lot line homes in the mall area that are individually owned, and that's why we chose these comparables.
Thank you. Ask a question. So how many tax parcels are assigned to this development?
I can answer that question. If you don't mind, I'd like to add a couple of facts. These properties were built in 2007, as has been previously noted. The market crashed for all types of real estate, as we all know, but in particular for zero lot line homes. When there's no real market for real estate, the most affordable, kind of least desirable, are likely to take the hardest hit. We saw quite a few developers lose these types of smaller zero lot line developments back to the bank. And that's what happened here. It was sold out of foreclosure to one entity. And then a few years later, they asked for tax purposes that we combine all of the parcel numbers so that they would only receive one tax bill. And of course, the county will do that. Every property owner has the right to reconfigure their property in any way that they choose. However, it does not negate the fact that every single one of these structures is on its own legal lot of record, and that adds value. They do all have individual utilities. That's a requirement when you have individual platted lots. As you probably all know, you don't have to share your utilities with your neighbor in the subdivision lot next door. And whether or not the current owner chooses to rent them as an income property doesn't negate the fact that, first of all, the Washington state statutes require that the sales comparison approach be used when possible. It is the preferred methodology per RCW 84-40030. And then secondly, that the county assessor is required to consider the highest and best use of property and value it as such. Otherwise, it violates our state constitution. And so that's why the assessor's office is continuing to value these as single parcels that could be sold to a single person, and that they're going to return a higher return on your investment than if you sold them as one income producing property. So they can rent them out, but it doesn't change their highest and best use. And I think I would argue that Greg has proven our point by suggesting a lower value using the income approach. Last, I did want to make sure we talk a little bit about the idea of a takedown schedule or giving them a discount for the time it would take to sell these 29 units. They have a website. Andy and I looked at that. We felt the properties were well-maintained, clean, newer paint, newer roof. Insides have been maintained, interiors have been maintained, which is what you want in a, you know, properly run rental property, and that you could in fact sell them as they were vacated without significant holding time or additional costs. And that's when you do try to give someone a discount for the time it would take property, that's sometimes called a developer's discount or a takedown schedule. I've heard it called a couple of other things as well, but that is not stated as acceptable in any Washington WAC or statute that I'm aware of. And Oregon and Idaho have explicitly ruled that that is unconstitutional because you're giving them a benefit and treating them differently than other properties by acknowledging a takedown schedule unless specified in state law. So we don't have that in Washington State. So my argument would be that highest and best use is as a single family residence. It's going to return a higher value. There isn't a significant holding time or cost that would need to be acknowledged. And the board really shouldn't be doing that anyway, based on prior decisions by the BTA.
Can I just make a statement?
Sure.
Okay. These are 29 units and they've been rented since inception. They have one single owner. So I guess the county's telling us that this owner needs to divest of
this asset and needs to sell them off. But you know, obviously the owner, this is a cash flowing investment asset they have. Obviously if they're going to divest of it, they're gonna, if they put it on the market, either they're gonna sell it in bulk to a single buyer, and the buyer is gonna continue to run it as an investment, or they may opt to take it and sell them off individually. However, if they do that, they're gonna be looking to receive a bulk discount on that purchase. They would not say, well, we think we can sell these for $325,000 a unit, and so I'll give you 29 times 325. They would look to be something lower so they can get a profit. And also there are absolutely going to be holding costs associated with this. The county has opined that they could sell these off relatively easy. I don't know how easy they could sell this if you put 29 units on the market all at once. Are buyers going to be rushing to, in a high interest rate environment, to try to buy these? Or is it going to take some time? I don't think that the county's provided any specific evidence as to how long that sell-off would take.
All right. I think I have everything I need. Any further questions?
None from me. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I do have one more comment in response to Greg's commentary. The median and average sale price in Clark County as of March is $550 to, I think, $625. And these are, we're not suggesting that these would sell for anything like that. These are entry-level homes that would be sold over time as the renters moved out. They appear to require very little maintenance because they are well-maintained. And there is no significant lead time at all, as Andy pointed out, to get these their individual parcel numbers, which is including their legal lot. This is a legally recorded subdivision. Andy provided a copy of the map. And the highest and best use returning the high with the highest return on their value, whether or not they wanted to sell it in bulk, is as single family residences, which the Clark County assessor is required to consider when valuing property. So our recommendation is that no change to the assessed value occur.
I assume that the company that owns this does all the maintenance of the property.
I think they hire a third party manager for that.
But I mean, it's all part of one thing. It's not, each person is not required to maintain their own property around their home and paint the property and all that.
No, that's the joy of renting. You don't have to worry about those things.
All right, I got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Unless there's anything else, we'll close that hearing.
This is the May 13th, 2025 hearings of the Clark County Board of Equalization. We have 15 minutes scheduled for this property. The hearing before us involves petition number 300 for property ID 92008204. The property is owned by Todd McClaskey. Board members present by video conference are Terry Hagberg and Chairman Daniel Weaver. We have no one present from the assessor's office, but we do have Greg LeBlanc here for the appellant with Joel Thompson observing. If you could please raise your right hand now to be sworn in.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you give in this hearing will be the truth under penalty for perjury?
I do.
Thank you. I won't give you the other spiel. You already heard it. So go ahead and tell us about this property.
Okay. I'm going to look to share my screen, if that's okay. I probably should have done this with the last hearing. This is the, we call it the Todd McClaskey residence. It's actually, as of the data value, it was an improved house, and located on the Columbia River, just east of the 205 bridge. Here's an aerial photograph. So our argument here is that the house does not have any value, and it's just land value. So we've concluded at a land value of $1,424,000, which is slightly higher than the assessor's land value. But again, we're arguing that the home has no value. The reason why we're arguing that is that the home does not exist to this day. It was demolished a month ago. So as we sit here today, there is no home on the lot. But as of January 2024, it was a home that was built in 1994. It had three bedrooms, three baths, and about 5,300 square feet of living area. So it was a large house, but it had not been updated since it was built in 1994, and there were some issues with it, including some dry rot from the eaves stucco, and it just was not in very good condition. With respect to this, you know, it had some other functional issues going on. It had, you know, whitewash cabinetry, you know, undesirable color palettes, weird patterns in the floor coverings, and, you know, obviously not updated fixtures. And it had kind of like, you know, sunken living room, all these things are not things that buyers are looking for. In addition, it had eaves siding damage around the windows, with large sections pulling away from the framing, improper alignment of the tile roofing, also causing cracking tiles and water leakage. In the end, the owner has decided to demolish the building that occurred last month, and they are planning to build a new home on the site. You know, our argument is that this is just land value. So we have a lot aerial here showing the picture of the building off Rivershore Drive. You can see that it's you know, fairly close to Rivershore Drive, and that's because of the setback requirements and the 100-year floodplain. So really, you don't, it can't be, the house has to be relatively close to the street. So the house is, this is about 1.5 miles east of the 205 bridge. So here's a plat map, you can see, and the red line being the 100-year floodplain, and the shoreline setback being the green line. You can see that that's why the house is situated the way it is on the lot. So it has to have ample setbacks for potential for flooding. And so the
So although the subject lot measures 28,589 square feet, the actual area that could be improved is less than 15,000 square feet. So it's about half the size of the lot. With respect to our valuation, we've just used a comparable analysis, and we've looked for sales of lots along the Columbia River in the same neighborhood. So we've looked at these sales and adjusted them. So we've got a concluded value of $54 per square foot. And that gives us a value of $1,543,806. And then we subtracted the demolition permit and costs off. And that gives us our concluded value of $1,424,000. So to get to the valuation portion, we've got sales of comparable lots. And you can see that these are relatively recent sales. The sales have occurred in the earliest one, September of 22. Then we have December of 22. And then we have one in June of 24 and one of July of 24. Those values range between looks like indicated sale prices between $16 and $81 a square foot, and all these were purchased for new home development. If we can see, here's a map showing the locations. So sale one is closest to us, and sales two, three, four, and five are all east of 205. All of them, except for, I believe, sale three, have river frontage. Sale three is set back off the river. However, it has a view. You can see the picture here for sale three showing that it's set back off the river, but it does have a very good view of the river. Sale one, again, is the closest one to us, but it's a much larger lot. It's at 115. Or almost 116,000 square feet. So it only sold for, it works out to $22 per square foot. And, you know, we see kind of an inverse relationship. The larger the lot, kind of the lower the sale price on a per square foot unit basis. And the smaller the lot, the higher. We note that sales, three and five are most similar in size to the subject. Sale three selling for being about 18,000 square feet, selling for $53 a square foot, and sale five being 22,651 square feet and selling for $54 a square foot. Really we've placed most weight on these sales, and we've concluded at a value of $54 a square foot. After we adjusted the sales range between $30 a square foot and $73 a square foot, an average $51 a square foot. So again, we're just a little above the average at $54 a square foot. So is there any questions regarding the valuation of the land here?
Well, I'm just saying, looking at it and saying, sale two is next to the freeway, but sales one and four seem to be the most like the subject property, and that is that, you know, they have the water access and all that. And is there any reason that you can see why sale four sold for such a high dollar per square foot, other than it's a smaller size?
No, I think it's just the smaller size, and you know, I think it, you know, it all just comes down to the utility of the site. You know, again, these are single lots. You're only going to be able to put one house on there. The lots have, you know, river access and views. So I think, you know, buyers are what they're just looking to. They're looking at what they can put on there for a finished product, and you know, typically if we look at like as a land residual basis, the land would account for about 25% of that value. They're you know, thinking that they could, you know, get or they probably wouldn't want to go too much beyond 30-35% for land value. So you know, they're thinking that they can get a $3 million house on there, in the case of sale four, they were willing to pay $1.3 million for the lot.
The other question I have is, when was the decision made to demolish the house?
I'm not entirely sure, but the
permit was actually applied for in January of 25.
Yeah, well, I assume that the decision was made before then. And I think they had a renter in the house up until, I don't know, July or September is sticking in my head, just going off the top of my head based on what the building owner told me. So they had somebody in there in January of 24 that was paying rent, but I think that they probably had a plan early on, because I think that they've engaged an architect. They've got architectural plans to build the house, so it's been in motion for some time.
They have I saw the prep work, the I guess the bid for the prep work, but the actual construction of the house bid is not in here.
Yeah, and it's not relevant at this time. I guess when the house is built and it's assessed, we can share that information if we have to appeal or not.
Right. I hear you. But that, I mean, that I look at that, and that's all prep work to get to building it. So then when you build a whatever you're going to build in there, that's going to be a pretty expensive property.
Yeah, it will one day be assessed much higher than $2.2 million.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Is there anything else of importance that you need to explain from this?
Nothing, unless you have any questions regarding the sales or the adjustments that were made.
Do you have any questions?
No, Dan, you've done a good job asking a few, and I don't have anything else. Thank you.
I think we have the picture.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, and thank you.
Thank you. Close the hearing.